Should we get started?
Yeah, let's go.
Okay. All right. Welcome back.
Welcome back. Sovereign Individual Chapter 2.
Sovereign Individual Chapter 2.
On the Hell Money Podcast. Mm-hmm. The only Hell Money Podcast.
Do you remember what the title is? It's like Mega Politics, blah, 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 something, something, something.
Mega Political Transformations in Historical Perspective.
Yeah. So talking about a bunch of mumbo jumbo as usual.
Yeah.
but I thought this chapter was actually really good.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I thought at first I didn't really like it. I thought that it was just kind of rehashing like themes for the in the beginning in the, from the previous chapter. But I feel like it ended very strong talking about, and I thought like, okay, megapolitics, like what is that? Like that's just some word that James and Lord William made up.
Yeah.
But then they actually like backed it up and they were like, no, this is what we mean by megapolitics. And these are the factors of megapolitics.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it was like insanely robust in terms of like they definitely could have used like more historical examples, mm-hmm. but it was fine. Mm-hmm. It definitely, I mean, I think CK told us that chapter one was the worst chapter. And so far that's true of two chapters. I mm-hmm. like chapter two better than chapter one.
I'm pretty positive about both of them. I'd say pretty wow. equally positive. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like sovereign individual sort of speaking your language. You know,
I still don't think I'm a sovereign individual.
I don't think you're a sovereign individual either. But I feel like the way that they see the world is very aligned with the way that you see the world.
Very true. Yeah. It's not a moralizing book. They don't talk about things as being good or bad. Mm-hmm. They don't talk about the current order as being good or bad. And they don't talk about these changes that they foresee as being good or bad. It's not a book about what ought to be. It's a book about forces and incentives and trends. And I do think that that is how I think the world is best correctly perceived. I think when people start to moralize, they just commit an error of reasoning. And they effectively like can't predict things if their worldview is what people should and shouldn't do, because that doesn't tell you about what ought or ought not to be. That's simply not a predictive framework. It's a framework for judging things in this sort of like useless way.
Yeah. One of the points that they made in the book that I thought was really resonated very truly, it's a kind of simple idea, but it's one that I feel like I've thought many times and not gotten a good answer to, is they say like that politics or like the changes that are made in human society are not the result of everyone like deciding that they want to change the things. Mm-hmm. It's more about like incentives that then create the changes. Right. So like, and I don't know, that was something that struck me a lot in 2020 when everyone was up in arms about whatever thing they were angry about at the time. Mm-hmm. I remember having this like sort of thing that I was hung up on that I kept asking people, which was, why do you think that like being loud about this and like making a ruckus and deciding that you really care about this will change it? Mm-hmm. Like, what is it? Because I feel like the messaging that I was getting at that time was very much like, go out in the streets, go protest, go make your voice heard. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I have never really seen an example of history or politics changing as a result of people feeling a certain way or liking or disliking a certain thing. And that's not to say that like I think maybe like it can be an indicator mm-hmm. of things. Like if people are upset about things, it's an indicator of certain situations that then result in changes made one way or the other, or mm-hmm. like a revolution happening or whatever. But to me, it doesn't feel like I've ever seen things change because people all sort of decided that they should change, rather than like incentives sort of.
Right.
And that's kind of what they get at with this. It's like history doesn't happen because we decide it should happen. History happens because of incentives.
Right. Maybe two counterexamples. I don't know how strong they are in the 60s, the protests against the Vietnam War. Mm. I wonder like, did that actually lead to the Vietnam War ending sooner? On one hand, maybe it did. On the other hand, that war was like a strategic and tactical catastrophe.
Yeah.
And maybe the protests had nothing to do with it, and it was just a losing battle that was ended. Another is maybe how the gay marriage becoming, I don't want to say legalized, but like gay marriage becoming like the Supreme Court decision on gay marriage sort of making it unconstitutional, the decision that it's unconstitutional to deny same-sex couples from getting married. That kind of seems like a gradual shift in how people feel, maybe. I don't know.
It's hard. I think it's like, for me, it's disentangling the protest as a symptom versus a protest as a cause.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. True. True.
Like, if the general tide is moving in the direction of, like, people thinking that gay marriage is okay, like, I guess a protest could be a catalyst to sort of the formalization of that, but is the protest really the catalyst of that, or is it just sort of like...
I think you're right.
You know?
I think you're right. Yeah, I think the protest is just something that comes after people have changed their minds for other reasons.
Right.
Yep.
And that's kind of... Yeah, I feel like that was something that they talked about... Yeah, a quote, important transitions in history seldom are driven primarily by human wishes. I guess primarily is the key word there.
Yeah.
And that's what I agree with. And yeah, I think like it's just, I feel like a lot of people believe the opposite, like where it's like things change because we decide that they should change. Things change because like we sort of become better people and we decide blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
and it's
many
like
such cases many of such people cases. Laboring under these misapprehensions.
Yeah, I definitely don't agree. I had a question for you that's sort of off topic, but also still on topic.
Yep.
I wanted to know, because this book talks about incentives all the time. Uh-huh. I mean, incentives are like the thing.
Yep.
Is incentives your God?
Mm.
Like in a, you know how like the atheists, like I believe in science, like science is real whether you believe in it or not.
Uh-huh.
Like Big Bang.
Yeah.
Like incentives are real whether you believe in them or not. Like is
definitely
that
something
your...
that I could say. Definitely something that I imagine myself saying.
Like are incentives your sort of like framework for reality making? In a way that like one might use like God or atheists might use kind of like cosmology?
Maybe. I think that they have like primary explanatory power. I don't know. I don't want to say no and be like, oh, that's not my God. You know,
I have no God.
I have no God.
No gods, no masters.
But, you know, if I have to put something in the God slot, well, I don't know. I mean, there's also like physics and shit.
That's I just, like, right. Are you more of like an atheist STEM bro? Or are you more like an economics?
I chafe under the term atheist. Like, I think I'm probably best described as an atheist, but I think the term atheist is very cringe. Yeah. I associate it with like our atheism on Reddit and like cringy internet atheists.
Well, what are like, I mean, the econ bros that really like love incentives, would you say that they mostly fall under like the atheist STEM bro umbrella? Or are they something else?
I don't know. I think the smartest economists don't, like the smartest people don't make value judgments about incentives. They don't think that incentives are good or bad. They think that incentives are just the primary framework under which human action is determined. And that if you want to determine human action and you want to change human action, you should use incentives. And that it doesn't determine what's good or bad, right?
Yeah.
Just determines like what is.
Well, that's the same with like science is real, whether you believe in it or not. It's like,
but I think those people give it a certain moral authority. You know, we believe in science, the truth of science, and are like filthy enemies, like refuse to acknowledge these truths.
I think that's a relative. Well, like when I think about, God, we talk about atheists like every single episode. It always comes back.
Very cringe.
To atheist culture. Well, like the way that this book talks about incentives is as if incentives were like a universal truth. And I think that's what I'm asking is like, where does that universal truth come from? Like at the bedrock kind of your beliefs, like
doesn't
is
come from
incentives
anywhere.
We just
observe that they exist.
Yeah. That's very atheist STEM bro of you,
I guess. Yeah. Bummer.
But like, I guess I'm just trying to get down to like the very bottom of your belief structure.
I don't think there's anything really there. A lot of confusion.
I think incentives is the bottom.
No,
where
but
you're
like
incentives kind of like,
yeah, but like
things.
I don't really know what's like good or bad. I have these vague ideas about ethics that I don't really talk about because I don't think I have very good arguments or that I have very particular reasons for believing them.
What do you mean you don't talk about? You talk all the time about how you think authority is bad.
No, that's sort of like from a consequentialist point of view. But like, why is authority bad? Like, authority is bad because I think it leads to bad outcomes. But why are the outcomes that I think authority produces bad? Generally, I'm sort of a negative utilitarian. Like the basis of my like ethical framework is that I think that suffering is bad and should be avoided. But I don't really know how to trade off suffering against against pleasure. A lot of utilitarians will sort of do this calculation where they're like, okay, we take the net amount of pleasure And then we sort of subtract the net amount of suffering. And that gives us this number. And if it's positive, it's good. And if it's negative, it's bad. Mm. And I think that that is very, has always struck me as very weird and very naive, that you can't just subtract pleasure from suffering from pleasure and get like, it's like subtracting apples from oranges or like fish from like, you know, like iPods.
And I think you need suffering in order to appreciate pleasure. Like if you're just trying to maximize that pleasure minus suffering equation, I think like at some point you'll reach like a tipping point where you don't appreciate the comfort that you're in.
Well, unless
the comfort becomes discomfort if you don't have something to like,
right. True. So, I mean, you could,
you know,
just,
everything's could, like relative and referential.
Practically. Yes. Yeah. Definitely true. But so then my conclusion then is like, okay, well, I'm like, suffering seems bad, but it doesn't seem like we can really offset it with some amount of pleasure. So then what do I do with that? Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, okay, well, maybe I should just try to destroy the world, you know?
What?
Because that would eliminate all the suffering.
Right.
Right. But then I'm like, okay, well, this doesn't seem to be really getting me anywhere. You know?
Yeah.
And that's why I don't talk about my ethical beliefs. So I'm like, yeah, I think it's good to avoid suffering, but I don't feel just from my intuitions, like my intuition is that like suffering is bad, but I don't think that I have like a very profound like ethical framework based on that. Like, I don't think it goes anywhere. Like a lot of forms of utilitarianism, like they get these weird quandaries. Like one thing is like, well, what if you have this like, what's it called? It's called the utility monster, I think. You have this monster that gets like enormous pleasure when it like rips people limb from limb and like devours them in an incredibly messy way.
Okay.
And let's say that it experiences such like ecstatic joy when it does this. If you're in a utilitarian framework where you think you can like subtract suffering from pleasure and get some like number, well, then clearly what you should do is you should just farm humans and feed them to the utility monster.
Right.
And a lot of this is, you know, this actually kind of gets into Sam Bankman-Fried and effective altruism and rationalists. Many of them like operate under sort of utilitarian frameworks, but they don't tend to acknowledge their limitations, or they don't think those limitations are very important. Mm-hmm. But yeah, these conclusions of sort of naive utilitarianism that you should feed people to the utility monster, or my sort of conclusion from my naive
extract the user funds from FTX in order to fund your effective altruism campaign.
Yeah, literally. And also my naive conclusion that I should just press the button and like end the world because that would get rid of the suffering. Mm-hmm. That's my naive negative utilitarian conclusion. And then I've thought about this a lot, and at the end I've just kind of thrown up my hands and I'd be like, wow, I guess maybe this just isn't a very good like lens to like see things.
It's very circular
and I think almost all morality and ethics are like this.
They're
simply, you have these axioms that you like assume, and then you get all these like very weird conclusions, and it seems like there's no set of axioms that you can assume that leads to like a really good framework. It's not like math where you like assume some axioms and then you get this useful mathematical system. It seems like all possible axioms that you could assume, at least any that I've seen, are kind of flawed. Mm-hmm. And so I try to operate under like sort of, I guess I sort of, a lot of the time I just operate under my intuition, like what seems bad, what seems good, like does this trade-off seem worth it? I also think that a lot of the time it's worth respecting people's preferences, even if those preferences are weird.
Yeah.
I think the mistake that a lot of people make is they just discount people's preferences and then be like, no, this is good or bad, and we should not pay attention to people's preferences if they go against what we think is good or bad.
Yeah, I'm unironically kind of like feelings over facts in that way.
That's preference utilitarianism, right? I'm like, well, like these people seem to be doing something, you know, and obviously like between consenting adults or whatever, and it seems to be leading to a bad outcome. But like,
I think for me,
I'm not going to override that.
I have a very postmodern perspective. I'm very postmodern. Mm-hmm. And I think like,
you're pre-modern, I think.
Like just like a middle-aged peasant.
No, I was thinking like cave woman, really.
Kind of. I don't know. I have a lot of thoughts going on. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not like primal in that way, you know, like I'm kind of postmodern in the sense that I feel like I'm sort of post irony. I'm too like culturally in the know to be like cave woman, you know, goals in some way, but not there. But I sort of have like a postmodern perspective that like, I don't have authority on truth, or nobody has authority on truth. And right. So what I think to be objectively true, or what I think are objective facts, I'm like, man, that's just your opinion.
Yeah, totally.
You know?
Yeah,
I think that's why I end up being more feelings over facts practically, like in the way that you're saying, where it's like, yeah, sort of just let people do what they want to do.
Yeah.
Because like, ultimately, who gets the authority of deciding what is true or good or right. useful right. or an yeah. ideal outcome? Yeah. It's like,
That's a lot of that. That I have my own one. The real reason that I hate authority is it just bothers me, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
But then when I sort of try to justify that, some of the reasons that I think hating authority is good is I think that, like, yeah, a lot of the time an authority is just going to make a mistake about what's good or bad, and letting people do their thing kind of has value because you avoid those kind of mistakes. Like, yeah, maybe sometimes you don't correct every bad situation, but it also avoids, you know, just steamrolling things when you think you're right, but you're actually completely wrong.
Let the incentives God figure out the outcomes. That's the basically dark, what dark you're God saying. Incentives. See, that's yeah. why I'm asking if it's your God, because I think that is ultimately, you're sort of like, well, allow incentives to... Like, only God can judge you. Only incentives can judge you. Like, in a practical way, yeah. you sort of view incentives as, like...
I vibe with that. Like, if I was, like, if I was, like, a Greek, like, cultist, you know, with some weird, like, Greek pagan god, yeah. I would probably at the god of...
Right. If you had to be worshiping at the altar of one god, yeah, I think it yeah, would yeah. be incentives.
Yeah,
or, like, Bitcoin, but that's sort of, like, under the umbrella of yeah, incentives.
I'd love a god of incentives. That'd be pretty sick.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what that temple would look like.
There's gotta exist, right? No, I don't know.
No, I think incentives is such an abstract concept. Like,
but there's a lot of abstract concepts that are gods. Like, love is pretty abstract.
No, then I guess that's not what I mean.
Or like different kinds of love, even.
Absolutely. No, I think incentives is just too much of a modern concept to have Christian or Christian saint or pagan god of incentives.
Hmm.
Like, I think that the idea The idea that incentives might wind up doing something useful, that you could just leave people to their own devices and through the interplay of their interactions and incentives, there would be good outcomes. That's a very new idea. I mean, that's Adam Smith, Invisible Hand, 1800s. I don't think that anybody was thinking along those lines before that.
I mean, Invisible Hand has God vibes. You know, it's like an invisible hand. Like, it's sure. actually like a yeah. sort of thing yeah. you could worship.
Okay, yeah, I worship at the altar of the invisible hand.
You're getting fisted by the invisible
hand. Listen, let's not, come on, give me some dignity here.
Yeah. No, that's actually, I'm taking note of that mentally because I've been trying to come up with, I'm trying to do some modern myth making.
Mm, okay, yeah.
Create new mythology. And I think God of Incentives is a good kind of direction for me to go in yeah. a little bit.
Back on SBF.
Yeah, right. I mean, we've barely talked about Sovind at this point, but we have to talk about SBF at least a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. So for people who don't know, Samuel Bankman-Fried was the CEO and founder of a prop trading firm called Alameda Research. That was the first firm that he founded, which was like a proprietary trading firm. Market making. Pretty famously, he exploited a difference in the price of Bitcoin in the US and Japan, and like flew dollar bills to Japan to buy Bitcoin and then send it back to the US and sell it. And
a genius.
Yeah, really takes a genius to do that. And then made a bunch of money. That was sort of Alameda Research's first big win, I believe. And then he founded an exchange called FTX. FTX was, I think, the second or third largest exchange in the world.
Yeah.
Got super huge. I don't exactly understand why it got huge over other exchanges. Like, what did they do?
I think they had pretty low trading fees. Like, I think they incentivized a lot of, like, trading from retail.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, numbers on that, but yeah. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, and then 2 weeks ago, approximately one and a half weeks ago, the FTX
on the Eclipse
House of Cards. Yeah, you nailed it with the Eclipse season on the Eclipse.
Told ya.
Yeah, FTX just fell with a House of Cards, like a House of Cards. Turned out that there was
unpredictable external chaotic event.
Yep, huge amounts of fraud and mismanagement. I think that they made that Alameda Trading made a large loss, and FTX used customer funds to bail out. Alameda Research, and then FTX was insolvent, and then there was a run on the banks, which revealed this insolvency as customers tried to tried to withdraw their funds and those funds were no longer there.
Yeah, and things are like still unfolding. I mean, honestly, I feel like by the time we even post this episode, there's probably going to be new information.
Yep.
But the CEO of Alameda was Caroline Ellison. Who's a fascinating, lovely character.
Let me just say first, like the I almost feel like it doesn't bear repeating. Like I think like, oh, everybody already knows this, but I don't think people actually know this. Like not your keys, not your coins. Like if you don't have your Bitcoin, if you don't control the private keys to your Bitcoin UTXOs, you don't own Bitcoin. You own IOUs that you're relying on the grace of some other entity to fulfill later.
I mean, so, this is the whole fucking point of 2008, is it not?
Yeah, like, whole point.
This is the whole...
And it's the whole point of Bitcoin, right? Yes. Embedded in the, you know, yes. Chancellor on the brink of bailout for banks, right? It's not just literal banks. It's also things that look like banks. So yeah. Not your keys, not your coins. Take custody of your Bitcoin off exchanges and just... humbly stack sats.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see how it all plays out because I really do feel like we're repeating a cycle with 2008 where it's like, you know, 2008, the banks were doing stupid shit with our money and then they fumbled the bag.
Yep.
Like, honestly, even in like a less malicious way than SBF, I would argue. Like, SBF, I feel like is more... Right. Intentionally sort of like draining funds in a way that
very intentional fraud, very intentional mismanagement. There was, like it was like SBF was a combination of systemic risk and fraud and mismanagement. 2008, I don't really know, but I think that it was mostly systemic risk and just people not
exactly sort of like people, which I'm not sure if it makes sense actually to, I think we have a tendency to be able to like assign blame to individual actions more than collective actions in the sense that like one singular person or two people, Sam Bankman-Fried and maybe a couple other people doing this sort of particular intentional fraud is an easier event for us to focus on than like hundreds or thousands of Wall Street dudes all doing the same thing in 2008. Yep. Like, I don't know. I guess just because it's easier for us to excuse people buying into something that's already happening rather than like actively going out.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, this ties into the chapter that we're reading of the sovereign individual.
Oh yeah.
Right. How? Because, well, you're talking about, you know, these individual actors and we focus on these individual actors, but these individual actors are micro fauna. They're small players.
True.
Right. And there's the macro fauna of, larger trends and, these players, these microfauna, they're playing micropolitics.
Mm-hmm.
But these larger trends are megapolitics, which is the, you know, the theme of this chapter. So we think of these people like, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried and Trump and Obama and Biden as being very important. We put a lot of emphasis on those people. We focus on what they do. We look to them for explanations to see what is happening or what will happen. But in doing so, we misidentify the actual actors behind movements in the systems of the system. And these are megapolitical forces. These larger, you know, so for example, Sam Bankman-Fried, obviously enormous mismanagement, but not the catalyst. The catalyst was this sort of the development of the buzzword of crypto and blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily a useful technology for anything outside of Bitcoin, or at the very least, massively overhyped for any use outside of Bitcoin.
I would argue it's sort of the gamification of finance and how, and crypto sort of fits into that because it just kind of incentivizes and I don't know, like the way that it even is designed is just for very quick, high frequency trading, cashing out on like huge sums of money.
VCs are essentially deploying massive amount of funds to create a financial video game that retail plays and then gets absolutely fucked when these VCs dump on retail.
There's actually a good quote in Chapter 2, Sovereign Individual, where he's talking about technology being this very important factor. I mean, technology obviously is the most important factor that he talks about in terms of like precipitating revolutions and kind of in the context of violence.
I think actually says that the previous three factors, like actually I think
it's topography, climate, microbes, technology. Those are the four that he talks about.
And I think he says that actually in some sense, topography, climate, and microbes are, this is an order of most important to least important. That topography is the most important, but it doesn't change very often. So for example,
yeah, you like, kind of know what it is.
Yeah. So like, for example, the sea is a very interestingly lawless place. Mm-hmm. Even in a world of nation states, no nation claims jurisdiction over the sea. The rule of law of one nation has never existed in the sea. It's simply, it's impermanent. It's easy to escape your enemies. It's hard to, there's no like fixed routes. So you can always, you know, just disappear into the sea. It's practically impossible due to the topography of the ocean to enforce the rule of law. And so we have this, you know, very interesting liminal legal space on the high seas.
Right. And they bring up, going off topography, they bring up this example of the first states in Mesopotamia and Egypt being floodplains that mm-hmm. were surrounded by desert,
right,
where the floodplains got easy access to water for their mm-hmm. crops, didn't right. really need to right. kind of like answer yeah. to anything.
Right.
But the farmers in the desert around the floodplains had to answer to the government within the floodplains because they needed access to the irrigation of the waters from the floodplains.
Right.
And so that sort of like topographical yeah. difference
created these very strong centralized states. Yeah.
Right. Right.
And so maybe topography is the most important, but it doesn't change very often. Like the sea is just kind of chilling, doing its thing. The floodplains right. are chilling, doing their things. And then we come to climate, which is also incredibly important. Climate in a way is like a form of topography. It's like, I guess it's not really, but it determines, you know, what you can do in a certain place. You know,
yeah, I think the two are intertwined, where mm-hmm. like climate affects different areas differently dependent on topography or mm-hmm. geography, right. however yeah. you want to say it. I think like his point with climate, the distinguishing thing between topography and climate is that topography doesn't really change,
right.
whereas climate does change.
Right, right. So you sort of have to separate the two because yeah. climate changes more frequently, right? A very interesting point about, you know, changes in, small changes in temperature, changing the length of the growing season.
Yeah.
Right? Huge difference in what you can do where, how large of a population you can support. Also changes in temperature, changing the altitude at which you can grow crops,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's another, you know, recession of where you can grow crops and how much you can grow.
Yeah, I mean, that's really like my concern with climate change is it really doesn't take that much climate change for destabilization, especially of a very fragile, like global supply chain. But it also is kind of like the self-regulating thing that I think, I don't know, I sort of feel like, if climate change is really such a big problem, it will eliminate global supply chains before, like we would reach a point of like no return yeah. where we're just like, cause part of the issue is just like the global kind of like output of carbon, the globalization of things and just like how technologically or like industrially advanced we are.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of think that like, yeah, if climate change is really such a huge threat, which I don't know, it's obviously a threat, but I think like, how much of a threat is yet to be seen, then climate change will wipe out the supply chain that allows for like mass human production of carbon into the atmosphere before,
oh, yeah,
you know what I mean? Like yeah. it's sort of like a feedback loop that right. will like self-regulate.
Right. Yeah.
And that's because I agree with kind of what they're saying that like even small changes in the climate do result in pretty big changes like globally to what you're able to grow,
yep.
What you're able to do in certain areas. And I think our supply chain is so fragile that...
I don't see the... I actually think that viewing the supply chain as fragile is kind of a mistake. I don't think that it's exact... I think you're right, but I don't think it's that the supply chain is fragile. I think it's that the existence of the supply chain makes the world more interdependent. I actually think the yeah. supply chain is probably... pretty robust, pretty good at responding to changes. But the existence of the global supply chain means that problems in one area can spill over into
other areas. It's the complexity. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like the collapse of whatever, the Bronze Age collapse yeah. was systems collapse.
Yeah. I mean, we could literally have a, if we had somehow a local climate emergency, like local climate changes or local changes of, you know, agricultural productivity in the United States due to the fact that the rest of the world is interconnected and gets a lot of calories from the United States could result in massive disruptions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, 200 years ago, that just wouldn't have been the case, right?
Yeah.
It would
yeah.
have been like, okay, well, it's, you know, the United States is fucked. Everywhere else is fine. They're not as interconnected.
Right.
Yeah.
Third factor, microbes. So disease.
Yep.
And we've seen, I mean, this is one of the things people point to as this book being like, prophetic in the sense yeah. that it talks about diseases and pandemics. And it even kind of says like you know, we haven't really seen
that
happen yet, but that's going to be destabilizing if it does.
I think that this is something that is, that we should give the authors a lot of credit for their position on microbes. They basically said, well, like, we've seen times in the past where microbes were a big factor. One of the examples they give is the inability of colonists, not really colonists, like, you know, early Portuguese sailors and like military, you know, detachments being unable to make much progress into Africa simply because they just got wiped out from malaria.
That was
sort of their big example. And then,
or then, like, in contrast, the New World, like, disease spreading through North America faster than even like the colonizers were coming through the continent because it just spread through the, like, native populations.
And then back to Africa, the development of quinine as an anti-malarial agent, meaning that all of a sudden, you know, they could make dramatic headway into Africa.
Yeah.
And they sort of said, like, well, like, they mentioned HIV, right, in the book. But they said, like, it hasn't been too much of a factor.
They kind of mentioned it as being, like, you know, if HIV did spread, like, a major pandemic, like, this is an example. Like, hasn't really panned out way. But, like, that as an example of something that would be sort of unforeseen. I think, like, the interesting thing about disease is it's unforeseen and unpredictable. Mm-hmm. Like, who gets sick and dies versus who doesn't. Obviously, there's some trend in one direction or another, but if it's, like, truly global, it's kind of like, you know, like, maybe you survive, maybe you don't, for like whatever sort of random reasons. And then they also talk about how mortality outside of war lowers the cost of mortality in war. Like, if you're already, like, expecting that your child is going to die of disease, you don't mind as much if your child dies going to war.
Right. It's all about relative risks. Right.
Whereas our threshold now is so much higher because we don't expect that, like, 1 out of 10 of our children is going to die.
I read something about, you know, there was some, like, you know, whaling edition or something. There was some job in, like, the 1800s where they paid some men to go live on an island and, like, collect seal pelts for, like, you know, like, a year. And they had to, like, subsist in, like, horrible conditions on this island collecting seal pelts. And the pay was ridiculously low by modern, like, standards. It was, like, you know, barely, seemed like it would be barely worth it. Yet these people were willing to do it because of the relative risks, right? Life back home as somebody who wasn't making any money was pretty bad. And, well, at least on this island, they got, you know, like, food and they, you know, reasonable amount of supplies. And so it was worth it for them to do this. Kind of same point as relative risks in war. When there's, like, high infant mortality, people randomly dying of disease anyways, you're like, well, I might go to war and randomly die, but, like, who cares? Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, yes, we should definitely give them credit for the microbe stuff because I think that's
COVID, because it already happened. Right. COVID was a mega political force. It was a force outside of politics that deeply changed politics that nobody could have predicted. And none of the actors that we think of as being very important, like Putin or Biden or Obama or Trump or Nancy Pelosi or Elon Musk or anybody, could do anything but react to it.
Yeah.
Right. They, yeah.
Yeah. And even though COVID wasn't necessarily, like, incredibly murderous or whatever, you know, not that many people died of COVID compared to plagues of history's past. Mm-hmm. It's still, I mean, I feel like COVID's the biggest thing that's happened in my lifetime.
Absolutely. I feel like COVID has changed
It's a things. Really good example of megapolitics, I think, where, like, politics, as we sort of think about it, is, like, Trump or AOC or these sort of, like, theaters of, but really those are kind of just reacting to the forces of megapolitics, COVID being a prime example of megapolitics.
One interesting counterexample, I think, is Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden is an individual. He is, like, a, you know, sort of what we would call a political actor. He's like microfauna. Mm-hmm. But he did do this one thing. He did make 9/11 happen. And that drastically shaped politics and changed and forced all the other political actors to react to that attack.
I think terrorism would be a good example of another kind of factor in megapolitics.
Well, yeah.
Like, terrorism, whether, and I think that also fits into, like, hacking, like, cybersecurity terrorism would be, like, another example.
So I think this actually gets, this ties into the next factor. So we had topography, climate, microbes. Factor four is technology.
Yeah.
And specifically, one of the sub-factors within technology that the book goes into is the balance between offense and defense. the equality and the predominance and the equality and the predominance of infantry. I think Osama bin Laden is an amazing example of this, because maybe Osama bin Laden wasn't the mega political actor, but maybe the mega political factor was the emergence of air travel and the ability of a small group of men to take over a flight and crash it into buildings.
Yeah.
Right. That just like the emergence of firearms equalized the playing field between very heavily and expensively armed knights and peasants with pitchforks. All of a sudden they all had guns. They could all use them about the same. This weird factor of airlines and these like giant planes flying around that anybody could just kind of take over and crash into a building. That was the mega political factor. And then Osama bin Laden was the micro political expression of that.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, one of the points that they make is that the powers that be always believe that the way that they organize life is the only possible way, and that we're at like the end or the apex of history. Mm-hmm. Like, whoever is in power, the sort of like political leaders, believe that what they're doing is like what else are we supposed to do? Which reminded me of like The End of History, which is like a Francis Fukuyama book that came out around a similar time as The Sovereign Individual, which is really interesting. But basically, End of History, the kind of thesis of that was that liberal democracies are the end of history, because once you reach like a very mature liberal democracy, they're not going to go to war with each other, because you don't have like the force to do it.
Yeah.
And then 9/11 was kind of this thing that people looked back in retrospect at Fukuyama's book and being like, you're an idiot, basically. Like, and I think this is a good example where, I don't know. Also, Francis Fukuyama, most famous graduate from my high school.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Random state high kid.
Nice.
But yeah, I think like, it is kind of interesting. Terrorism, I guess, would fall under technology because it's ubiquity of the ability to fight back,
right?
Or like to
no, fight. I think so. Yeah, I think terrorism is a is in the same is terrorism is a result of the increased availability of small arms, right? And individuals being able to effectively arm themselves, not just small arms but also explosives. The development of like very powerful, very very small explosive devices, that's the primary driving factor behind terrorism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the points they made that I thought was incredibly based was that like the idea of all men being created equal was not talked about before guns were ubiquitous.
Right. Because it simply wasn't true. And guns made it true.
I was like, damn, go off.
I listened to a really great podcast. Recommend everybody check it out. Popular Front. It's by Jake Hanrahan, who's sort of into sort of the niche and very geeky details of modern warfare. Entire episode about rebels in Myanmar using 3D printed guns. In particular, the FGC9, the Fuck Gun Control 9 semi-automatic handgun created by Jay Stark, I think his name. He died. Jay Stark, rest in peace. Actually starting to be a significant factor, right? The ability to manufacture with a 3D printer a pistol that works pretty well. Myanmar rebels actually using these pistols in ambushes and being on Facebook talking with 3D printing like gun bros, being like, hey, we have this problem with this firearm, it tends to jam. The 3D printing gun bros being like, oh damn, here's this like modification, we tried it out, seems to work. Myanmar rebels being like, thank you very much, that's awesome.
I mean, this is the perfect example of technology as like a mega political factor.
Absolutely.
Like both the internet and the ubiquity of like access to firearms. Actually kind of bringing it back to Sam Bankman-Fried, which I think is why
circling
we started
the train
going through,
around Samuel Bankman-Fried.
One of the things that, this is a quote from Sovereign Individual, quote, wars of the next millennium will include some almost bloodless battles fought with computers.
Yep.
And he's, describes this as being like literal cyber soldiers, like robots like fighting with each other.
Yeah.
And I think that this is like a very common tendency from people that try to predict the future, whether this is like sci-fi, sort of like a fictionalization of like a sci-fi dystopia, or like literally trying to predict the future with like AI or whatever, is there's a tendency to try to anthropomorphize like technology, where it's like, oh, we're gonna have literal cyber soldiers out there fighting each other, or we're gonna have like AI sex bots that look like the hottest girl you've ever seen or whatever. And it's like, okay, but maybe the easiest thing for like literal cyber warfare is just like crypto bros trading little tokens with each other online and like the gamification of finance. Like, I think that like the gamification of finance is an example of like cyber warfare where like it has real economic realities, right?
I think,
but it's gamified and it's like just through technology. It's sort of like an Ender's Game situation where like the people that are actually doing it are so removed from the actual physical outcome of what they're doing that they're mm-hmm. able to commit violence in a way that's mm-hmm. beyond what they would physically do if they physically had to do it.
I actually sort of think that like crypto, non-Bitcoin crypto and DeFi is maybe not even a mega political factor. I think it's maybe too minor and won't really have any lasting impact. I actually think the conflict, which is a bloodless, quiet conflict, is simply the state losing ground to Bitcoin. And no, it's not something that's as dramatic as, you know, DeFi blowing up. It's just people being able to opt out of that system. And we haven't seen any conflict around it. The reason I say that crypto and DeFi is like maybe not a mega political factor is I kind of just don't see it going anywhere. Like
it's just
like a new video game dropping that's like very popular, a new form of gambling. Yeah. And is very popular, very gamified, right?
I don't think crypto is a mega political factor. I think it's like a response to a mega political factor, which is like the digitization of fiat, like becoming just like making it explode so much faster and more pronounced than it would have otherwise. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that like being able to do all this like robo high frequency, like gamified trading
right.
is like sort of like inflating fiat into like a level of disreality and like yeah. disconnect from economic reality. Basically, it's just like furthering and accelerating that process. So I think it's not that like DeFi or crypto is the mega political factor. It's more that the mega political factor is the digitization and gamification of finance.
Of like finance and reality.
Technology.
That you can do it online by pressing buttons.
Exactly. Right. And so people like Sam Bankman-Fried are like, heh.
Yeah.
Like, I could win it all back if they just let me in, you know?
Right, right, right.
Is Sam Bankman-Fried a sovereign individual?
No, because he's getting ass-fucked by the state right now. It's going to be a long process.
I thought he hasn't been arrested yet.
Doesn't matter. He's going to get arrested.
You think he is?
Yeah, I think so. I think that.
I don't know.
I think that the powers of be will. Well, okay. So let me say what I was going to say, and then say maybe it was wrong.
Okay.
So my first thought is like, yeah, the people are really mad, and politicians love to, you know, find scapegoats and like you know, have like a corpse to hang in front of the angry masses. And Sam Bankman-Fried seems like the ideal corpse.
But they're not doing that. They're like writing puff pieces about how like
right.
you know,
that's what they're what I was gonna say is that like the New York Times is writing this insane puff piece where Sam Bankman-Fried is like just this like nice guy who like kind of lost his way a little bit. I don't know. I feel like he has to be made an example of. I think that you don't think so.
I don't think
so. Do you want to make a bet?
So, okay, sure.
Let's bet.
What's our bet? Yeah, what's the bet? That he will be arrested?
Yeah, so I think that Sam Bankman-Fried will be arrested.
I could see him being arrested, but I kind of think he like won't.
How much? Let's make it a bet on how much time he serves.
Okay.
How much time do you, what do you want the benchmark to
I
be?
Think he might serve no time.
No time?
I don't know.
Oh, I'll take that bet easy.
Okay, what are we, what
I mean,
are we betting?
Like maybe like 100,000 sats.
Okay, I don't even know how much that is, but sure.
That's 1/1000th of a Bitcoin, so it's like $16 right now.
All right, let's do it.
Okay,
that's like 100 generational wealth.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Insane generational wealth. Like whoever wins this bet, our ancestors are going to be listening to this, and they're going to be like,
"Fuck you, Casey."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And your ancestors are going to be super like rich. Like this was the basis of our political empire. That bet between Aaron and Casey was the mega political factor.
I don't know. I kind of think like, I mean, again, it's like who the fuck knows? Like this bet is pretty low stakes. I'm happy to lose it, but it feels to me like he's going to get away with it, or maybe Caroline Ellison will be able to get away with it.
Well, you know, where you know, Caroline Ellison getting away with it, I think that's neither here nor there. I
mean,
wouldn't make a bet on
that. If Caroline Ellison gets away with it, maybe she's the first sovereign individual.
I don't know.
She's like living in Hong Kong, doing all this like crazy ass shit, gets to Dubai, doesn't get arrested, and gets to like live out her Tumblr girl Harry Potter fan fantasy. Like, that's pretty sovereign individual of her.
I think that the sovereign individual of the sovereign individual, the book, is somebody who is able to successfully and quietly evade or fall not fall under the watchful eye of the state in the first place.
But that feels not, that feels like that already happens, right? Like there's already so many people that like have cash only businesses and evade taxes and all this shit. Like that already exists.
I think the hypothesis of the sovereign individual is that the scope of those individuals' activities will increase and increase. And it won't just be somebody running a cash only like import export business that makes the money and they, you know, evade the state and they live on some island, mm-hmm. but that these people will command more and more and more resources, right?
I think the reason why I point to SBF and Caroline Ellison as being examples of sovereign individuality potentially is that like...
Sovereign individuality, I like that. Sovereign individuation.
Is like, it's actually...
Sovereign indivisibility.
It's actually providing a test, right? Like evading and sort of like flying under the radar is fine until all of a sudden the government cares about you for some reason because you're saying things that they don't like or you're like actively breaking their laws in a way that's like embarrassing them or whatever, mm-hmm. which I feel like is what SBF did, mm-hmm. basically, is like he broke the law or defrauded investors or whatever in a way that in theory the US government wouldn't like. And so the test is like, will he be able to evade it through his personal wealth? I mean, okay. I guess also the question here is like, do you think that Sam Bankman-Fried is like the top mm-hmm. of the totem pole because he's like donated to all these people and kind of like has control over all these agencies through his money or mm-hmm. like the money that he was stealing? Or do you think like Sam Bankman-Fried is like an op who's like, this is like a controlled demolition downfall situation? I know you don't think that's
not those
very
theories
conspiratorial,
are just insane.
But I think like it could be one or the other. Again,
I think
like,
the test is going to be, you know, is the New York Times writing this weird fluff piece about Sam Bankman-Fried even after his empire has crumbled? Is that just an anomaly that, you know, he kind of tribally aligns with these people and so their first article about him was very positive, but then things are going to change and they're going to get increasingly hostile towards him? Or is it a actual indication that, yeah, he is going to get away with it, that he had the levers of power in his hand? I think it's hard to tell, and that's going to determine whether he was a sovereign individual
or not. I think
it's
the second. The reason why I say that is because while he is like an effective altruist Bill Gatesy type, mm-hmm. the New York Times hates crypto. Like that wing right. of yeah. like the ideological wing that the New York Times represents hates crypto. They don't get it. They think it's stupid, which uh-huh. like it is. They're yeah. right, but they don't like, that's not an educated opinion on their part.
No, I think it is an educated opinion. I think they correctly perceive it to be eroding, to be taking... To make the policies that they favor hard to implement.
The reason, oh yeah, that's a fair point. Okay, so maybe you're right. So yeah, they hate crypto. And I think they're also like not, it's not an unpopular opinion to shit on billionaires. Mm-hmm. Like I really don't think that they're in the business of just protecting billionaires for the sake of like, well, he donated to these things that we kind of like. Like, I don't know. I think that they'd be willing to make him into like a scapegoat or kind of a clown or mm-hmm. whatever. I think it's strange and purposeful that they are painting him the way that they are. Mm. And the question is that because he has all this, you know, he's donated all this money and sort of amassed all of this influence and power, mm-hmm. or is it, which I think you probably disagree with, or is it because he's like a part of a greater plan that like the New York Times is kind of going along with?
Yeah.
And I think if the answer is that it's because he has all this sway and political power because of the money that he's donated and that results in him getting off, like, from his charges, then he is sovereign individual because he's using his wealth to sort of sway and control nation states.
I think he would be a sovereign individual, but in some sense, but I don't think he would be the kind of sovereign individual as predicted by this book. I think he would be just a classic person who wielded political and economic power, like a standard political actor, right? If he just makes a bunch of money and donates to
yeah, he's not really powerful causes. He's not really using technology to like evade. It's more just like
he's not. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Although in some sense, I mean, it could be that you know, if the sovereign individual like miscalculated a little bit and the future is not these like, you know, powerful shadowy cyber figures. And actually just people amassing wealth in a way that wasn't powerful, what wasn't possible before, but then using that wealth in sort of traditional political ways, like making donations and cozying up to journalists. Maybe the future is dominated by that kind of individual and not this like cyber sovereign individual.
I think it can be both, but I think like what's emerged, like I think it's different forms. Like I think what Sam Bankman-Fried is doing by sort of controlling all of these things through his money, mm-hmm. I think is pretty sovereign individual of him. Mm. But it's not like evading in this. And I mean, also like having his business in the Bahamas, like offshore.
For right.
Like,
that's, you know, true. That actually is true. Is like the reason I think if he was in the US, he would be like insta arrested.
And
right
even
now.
Sort of like the underlying narrative of like, oh, they're all trying to flee to Dubai.
Right.
Like that right. is yeah. like very sovereign
jurisdictional
individual.
Arbitrage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I
true.
Also
yeah.
just side note. I have fully incorporated sovereign individual into my vernacular mm-hmm. where now I say, oh, that's a very sovereign individual of you. Mm-hmm. Like if someone does something that's like very sovereign individual
yeah.
or I'm like, that's not very sovereign individual of you.
Mm-hmm. Strong Bugman vibes.
Exactly. That's the other version is strong Bugman vibes
yeah.
is like, those are the two yeah, options.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
Bugmen are not sovereign at all.
Like when we got food and you were like, oh, let's go deliver. And I was like, it's literally a block away. Let's go
Listen,
pick it up.
Listen, you don't
need
to tell people about the time that I didn't want to walk a
I'm
block.
Just saying, as an example, like that's Bugman
vibes.
Well, you alternate between the two. You are either sovereign individual vibes or Bugman vibes. Like
I'm a sovereign Bugman.
You're very futuristic in yeah. this way. But yeah, so I just want to let everyone know. Yeah, sovereign individual versus Bugman vibes is a new way of explaining the world that I really like.
Yeah.
Also, an aside question that I had. In thinking about sovereign individuals, what if sovereign individuals are so sovereign that they can't get girlfriends? They're too sovereign. I think this is a problem.
Interesting.
The people that I know that most exemplify sovereign individual characteristics.
I think that for the very sovereign individuals, having a girlfriend kind of cramps their style.
Exactly.
You know, they
That's
just don't want to bother with it. They're too sovereign. They don't want to be tied down. Yeah.
I think this could potentially be a problem.
Listen, it's a problem for me. All right. I'm too sovereign for a woman.
Sovereign.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I honestly think like I know so many single Bitcoiners and I think it's this issue. They're too fucking sovereign.
Yeah, they'd have
they
to give
don't
up a
wanna,
lot.
Yeah, they don't want to compromise. Like a relationship with another person is kind of like getting cucked by the government.
It is. Yeah. Yeah, mommy nation state to mommy GF.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to make a lot of compromises.
You have to make a lot of compromises.
You can't
you have to give up a lot
want.
Of personal. Yep, yeah. Yeah. No, and this is why I don't think I'm like very, I'm sovereign individual in certain kind of practical ways, mm-hmm. but I actually don't think I'm that sovereign individual because like, I don't like guns that much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really love the idea of being like, I'm defending what's mine. Mm-hmm. Like I'm okay with being a part of a larger group that does that. But like personally, I don't really like the idea of being a sovereign individual. I prefer to be like with others and like make certain compromises for my relationships with others.
Yeah.
But that's
why you're in a relationship and why I'm not.
Exactly. It's not very sovereign individual of me, but it's also not very bug man of me.
Uh-huh.
You know,
no, that's pretty,
that's why I'm trad. What else should we talk about? Oh, we didn't talk about Rome at all.
Yeah. So I think the big question. So the book.
They talk about the fall of Rome.
Yeah.
Which was super interesting. I really liked that part.
Great, great quote here. Long after Rome's demise, the fiction that it survived was held out to public view like Lenin's embalmed corpse. Nobody who depended on the pretenses of officials for his understanding of the news would have learned that Rome had fallen until long after that information ceased to matter. And they give a lot of examples about how, you know, the time that we identify as being the fall of the Roman Empire, a lot of the bureaucracy and sort of procedures of Rome continued, you know, like people were like nominally in power, you know, the Senate or whatever, you know, continued to like meet or whatever.
Yeah,
and
they said, quote, these changes did not appear to be the fall of Rome, but merely negligible shifts on the surface of the national scene.
Yeah.
So this was like 476 is sort of what like we consider to be the actual fall of Rome, but it mm-hmm. wasn't until the 5th century that people actually kind of knew that Rome had fallen. And they say like, okay, that's something easy to pin on like the spread of information now versus then, like, mm-hmm. well, back in that day, maybe people just didn't hear about it. But they kind of say like, no, it's not that there wasn't a flow of communication. It's what you were saying that like things sort of proceeded, like there were still kind of like government meetings and like there was this kind of pretend I guess the reason why it fell is that like the last emperor fell to a barbarian king Odoacer. I don't know. I think I looked up the pronunciation, but I could be wrong. King of the Goths.
Yeah.
I found a quote from Wikipedia that said in 376, unmanageable numbers of Goths, you know, coming in. Just, I mean, can you imagine if we had unmanageable numbers of Goths? Like, you know, like in a mall goth sort of context.
Uh-huh.
I actually look kind of goth.
You look a little goth today.
I look a little goth.
So the big question is, has Rome already fallen?
Yeah, has Rome already fallen? Well, sort of thinking about it from an astrological perspective. So the second Roman Empire Pluto return was 461 to 467.
Mm-hmm.
And then Rome fell in terms of like a historical looking back on it, 476.
Yeah.
So it took like a little under 10 years, about 10 years
yeah.
from like the Pluto return to actually falling. That context for now, our Pluto return is happening currently. So it would be 2032, like ish, that things would actually fall, but still we wouldn't even really know about it for like another couple decades. This is me sort of like framing it in the way that I understand the world. And that kind of makes sense with, remember when I was doing the astrology of Bitcoin episode and I was saying 2032 is like kind of this big fucking moment to see like, does Bitcoin win or does like the centralized power win?
Yeah.
All of this is making me think like, I don't know that like Rome, like our Rome, our Roman Empire of the United States, like I'm not sure if it's fallen. I think we're in this kind of like process of falling. And I feel like 2032 is sort of the date that I'm looking for to be like kind of being able to be ahead of the times and predicting it. But I still don't even think it will be accepted.
Yeah.
But I don't think we've fallen yet.
I think that we haven't fallen yet. But the mega political factors that will cause the fall of our current order are already well underway.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
they've
yeah.
already sort of started to emerge. They're the internet, their information, their Bitcoin. And that timeline sounds about right. Like it sounds like the idea that like around 2032, like in another 10 years, we'll know that something is up. Something will clearly
be wrong.
Up.
Something is broken.
And maybe the shape of things to come will start to emerge.
Well, it makes sense too with like the timeline for the fall of the Roman Empire. Wikipedia says like 376 is when there were like these unmanageable numbers of Goths coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of like the barbarian Goth kingdom that kind of ended up taking over and causing the fall of the empire. So that's like 100 years basically from like the factors that then contribute to the fall. But technology speeds these things up, right?
Right.
So in, you know, 400, in the year 400, it took 100 years for Rome to actually fall with like the sort of initial input of the unmanageable number of Goths.
Right.
But now, since technology is rapidly accelerating these things, what, Bitcoin came about 2008, 2032, looking at like an actual fall.
Right.
Yeah. Seems more reasonable to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
I'm excited too.
I mean, I just love witnessing, you know? Mm,
yeah. Bearing witness.
I love bearing witness. Just like Jesus.
I like bearing witness too. I love, I love chaos. I love like weird destructive events. I mean, I don't like that they happen, but I'm fascinated with them.
Yes,
they
exactly. It's a fascination.
Yeah.
Is there anything else we should talk about? I'm looking through our notes now.
Last thing I think is I really like just the observation of the open sea as this lawless place.
Mm.
And I think that cyberspace is that new open sea, that new lawless open sea. But it's not a physical place. It's a like sort of an overlay on the existing topography.
Mm-hmm.
Like a new lawless high seas everywhere that everyone can access.
You kind of have like, if I am an unmanageable number of goth vibe with my outfit, you kind of have like Greek taking to the sea, like Mediterranean Ocean vibes going
very,
on right now.
Very BAP Caribbean rhythms.
Yeah,
kind of
100%.
Thing. Sea people conqueror.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we're both sort of representing our different sides of the decline. Yeah, I like that too. I mean, I think the sea is beautiful and poetic and that like, I don't know, it's so earthly. But we have so little control of it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, the open sea still is this topographical area that we can't really govern.
Continues to be the realm of pirates, even to the modern day.
Right. Exactly. It's beautiful. Mm. It's like a statement on, you know, how little we actually understand or can control things, even as technology advances.
Yeah.
Should we end it there?
Yeah. Let's call it.
All right. Thanks, Casey.
Hmm?
See you next time.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.